that next year. Okay. Now it worked.
I started the recording.
Thank you. Yeah, for some reason I stopped having a button to do that. Thank you for doing so, Elizabeth. And Jeff Norman is going to continue as Assistant Secretary Treasurer. Secretary Treasurer Jim Simpson has agreed to run. Tom Crone has agreed to run till next year for the trustee. That's a four-year position, so he's filling in somebody else's. And Bernard Kaufman has agreed to do it till July of 2027. Okay, are there any other nominations? I'm not going to wait a long time. Okay, hearing no other nominations, how about we have a simple up-down vote? And here is the instructions.
I move they be everybody be elected by acclamation.
Motion is seconded.
Okay. Let's see.
I move the question.
All right. Now, how do we say that we're in favor? There's supposed to be a little button, and I don't see a button.
Go to reactions and down there.
I don't see reactions.
Yeah, I know.
I don't see it.
Hey, yeah, Don, way down at the bottom.
Guy, you have to look at your Zoom screen, not the PowerPoint screen.
I am looking at the Zoom screen.
There's a raised hand at the reactions.
I don't even see a raised hand.
No, use the check mark or the X mark to signify it because the raised hand.
Now I see it. Okay.
All right. Those go away. So use the check mark or the X mark.
Okay, I got it. Please. Okay. So down at the bottom, does everybody see the reactions?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so NCA members get to vote. So
I said yes.
Okay.
So did I.
And all right, so.
Everyone raised their hand.
Okay, so we got, let's see. Okay.
Mike, okay, good.
Members should
vote.
Okay, looks good.
I have 12, I have 13 positive, none negative.
Okay, so I would say that we have indeed elected the new slate, so congratulations. Okay. Any other announcements before we go to the speakers? And John, did you want to introduce Steve and Saraga?
No, I think the Stardust does that.
Okay. All right, Saraga, tell us a little bit about yourself and about your project. And Steve, I hope you don't mind going second.
Can I screen share my presentation?
You should be able to screen share, sure. I hope.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, can everyone see this?
Yes. Now I can. Yes.
Okay. And can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So my name is Saraga Surendra, and I interned at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory under Mr. Alan Mick. And together we worked on a feasibility study where we wanted to see if it was feasible to implement a Python interpreter onto NASA's Project Dragonfly. So first I wanted to go into a little bit of background on what the Dragonfly mission is and how we basically came up with our feasibility study and how we created the foundation steps for what we wanted to do. So Dragonfly is a rotorcraft that is being sent to Titan, which is Saturn's largest moon, in 2027, and it is currently in its developing stages. So what it's going to be doing is it's going to be investigating the atmosphere and surface features of Titan to find similarities to prebiotic Earth. But since Titan is so far away, it's easier to have the mission run on autonomous pre-programmed functions. So the rotorcraft is going to be running on pre-programmed functions because it's harder to send instructions directly to the rotorcraft from Earth. And because of this, the amount of data that it has to send back to Earth is greatly increased because these instructions have to keep going back and forth. And the data is sent through a process called direct data transmission. And that's when the mission is going to point an antenna at Earth, and a radar dish on Earth is going to catch that data because it's really hard for satellites to be able to pick up on this data between the two points. And the radar dish is going to catch that data, and then scientists are able to investigate the data that is caught from radar dishes all around Earth. So the issue that we found is that data transmission is very slow, especially with Titan being so far away, which I discussed in the previous slide. And the amount of data received from mission is measured by this item called the data rate. And the data rate is defined as the amount of data sent to a specific location over a certain time interval. And this can be affected by interferences that are between the rotorcraft and Earth, or the distance between the two locations. And these interferences could be different items in between, such as planets or asteroids or comets that are basically affecting the radio waves from getting transmitted between the two locations. So now I'm going to go into my project itself. And so the goal on my project is to make the most of the limited data rate, because the data rate itself cannot be changed. And how I want to do this is we want to implement a Python interpreter. So a Python interpreter is a programming language that we want to be able to use on the Dragonfly mission. And by doing this, we hope to improve the amount of relevant data that is sent down to Earth by sorting through data on board the spacecraft instead of sorting through data after it comes back from Earth. And we want to do this by only sending back the highest quality data from the Dragonfly mission. So this is a feasibility study, which means we want to see if the Python interpreter works on a Dragonfly spacecraft, and we want to determine if Python can recreate existing mission software, which was already found on the New Horizons mission, which was a mission to Pluto a couple years back, but in a faster, easier, more efficient, and more flexible way. And inherently, as an interpreter language, which means the instructions are processed line by line instead of all together, Python libraries can allow scientists to upload their own code to the spacecraft, allowing for more flexible use of this. And what we are trying to say with our problem statement is that if we are able to get a higher quality image data using our Python interpreter, then we can prove the feasibility of our project. Next, I'm going to go into the methods of exactly how we managed to do this, exactly how we managed to prove the feasibility of this. And before I do that, I want to go a little bit into CCSDS packets. Okay, so CCSDS packets are space packets, and they're exactly what contain the data that is being used to send everything from the rotorcraft to Earth and from Earth to the rotorcraft. And so the format and structure of the CCSDS packets are very specifically defined, which makes it easier for us to organize and analyze data that we are looking at from the rotorcraft. And we can use this format and structure to observe it as it goes from the spacecraft to the ground station. So inherently inside the CCSDS packet, it's always going to be binary data, and it is stored in a hex file format. So because it's stored in a hex file format, this means the data is represented in hexadecimal, which is base 16. And these CCSDS packets can include data that are images, the spacecraft position, the velocity, etc. Just basic things that scientists might want to know about the spacecraft. It just contains all sorts of data, which is represented in the hexadecimal format. And then later on, the scientists can convert the hexadecimal into what they understand. So they use those hexadecimal numbers to convert it into their own language, so they understand what they're seeing. And this is kind of the structure of a CCSDS packet. So it's split into the primary header, the secondary header, and the data section. So what you see right here is the primary header, and it looks like a lot, but it's just used to organize the data that you're looking at on the CCSDS packet. So from the primary header, we used the application process identifier, which is seen right here, in order to identify what packet we're looking at. And then we look at our packet data length to see exactly how large our image is, or to see how large whatever data that we're getting is going to be. So in our primary header, it's only basic identification information, and it's not going to give you any information that you want to know, because that is going to be in your actual data section. And then, as I said before, we have the application process identifier, which we want to be looking at, and then our packet data length. So these are the only two sections that we really focused on out of the entire primary header that we saw before in the previous slide. And then next in the CCSDS packet is your packet secondary header. And the part of the secondary header that we wanted to use was the time code field. And what this does is it gives you the time range that your packet is coming from, so you can see exactly like when that data is from. For example, if you have an image and you want to know exactly when that image is taken, your time code field is going to give you the exact timestamp of when that image is taken. So you can see exactly like, you can compare the time ranges of the different positions and see how that's working. Yeah. So in order to figure out our Python interpreter and to figure out the feasibility of implementing it, we had to follow a software development method. And so what we did is we first designed it on a higher level, which means a very basic design. We used a chart just to organize what exactly we were doing. And then we moved on to designing it to the lower level. So we wanted to see exactly what functions we needed to use in our Python library. And then we moved on to the actual implementation, which is essentially just using the predefined headers that we had already created in our lower level design to actually code the library and create the functions that we wanted to use later. And then we move on to the testing, which is when we use sample CCSDS packets, which, as I said before, we had gotten from the New Horizons mission. So we're using the sample CCSDS packets just to see if it's feasible to use the Python interpreter. And then later on, when the actual Dragonfly mission launches, that's when we have our deployment. So our Python library is going to go onto the Dragonfly software, and then we can see it launch with that. All right. So in our design phase, we had certain functions that we used in order to go through the CCSDS packet. So first, what we had to do is we had to actually open the packet, and then we had to move on to reading the packet. And when we read the packet, it was in a binary format. So reading the packet is very different from a normal reading of some text file that you might normally see. So after we read that packet, we have to sort it in through our primary header and our secondary header so that we can get all the different functions that we need. And then after we sort it into the primary header, the secondary header, and get the specific components of the primary header and the secondary header that I talked about before that we wanted to observe to see the packet's information, we can then publish the packet. And by publishing the packet, I mean that you essentially have sorted the data inside of the packet to see your highest quality data. And that's exactly what you want to send down. So by publishing the packet, it just means that you're sending it back down to Earth. Okay. So in our implementation and testing part of it, we had to basically use our hex file and sort through the hex file. So on the left, on the right, you can see an example hex file, and all those numbers are representing hexadecimal data. And since the hex files are compressed binary data, you can later decompress that to see exactly what you want to see and decode that data. So when you see a hexadecimal file, your first six bytes or your first six numbers in the file are going to be your primary header, which I talked about before. And then your second six bytes are going to be your secondary header. And then the bytes until the end of the packet length is going to be your data section. And as I said before, your packet length is going to be coming from your primary header. So in every single file, there's always going to be a primary header and your secondary header. It's always going to have the same information over and over again. But your data length, your packet data length might change. So you have to define until when you want to stop writing those bytes so that you can get the proper image and the proper data section. Yep. And so inside of our hexadecimal file, each line of data in the data section of the packet essentially represents a scan line. And a scan line is just a line in an image. So even when you're looking at this computer right now, like, you can see individual pixels if you get really close. And when you go across a row and you see each of those individual pixels are coming together to create one row, that's going to represent your scan line. So your scan line is essentially just a row of pixels in an image. And since our data is in binary, your zeros are going to represent your darker spots, and your ones or greater are going to represent your brighter spots. And we can do one or greater because it's in a hexadecimal format, whereas in binary, it's just going to be zeros and ones. So on the right, there's an image to represent scan lines and represent the darker lines and the lighter lines. So your darker lines are going to be your rows of zeros, whereas your lighter lines are going to be rows of ones. And different numbers in your hexadecimal file can represent different colors that you might see in an image. So we specifically concentrated on image data to prove the feasibility of getting higher quality image data. So the process that we used for getting one high quality image is we used co-adding. So co-adding is when you take the average of data from multiple images, and then you add those hexadecimal numbers together and you average them out, and then you can get one clear image. And the reason that we do this is because across all the images, there's gonna be lots of stars and there's gonna be lots of static. So when you only want to observe the stars, you're going to want to cancel out the static that is constantly moving in each of the images to make sure that you get one clear image that has no static and only the stars that scientists can observe. And the way we did this is we took multiple CCSDS packets from the exact same time range, and then we co-added them. So the way that we took multiple files from the same time range is we looked at the time range from the CCSDS packet secondary header that I talked about before, and then we were able to observe that those images are kind of similar, except they have a lot of static in them. And then when you co-add them, you can get the stars and then observe exactly which ones are the stars and see how that affects the image. So what we did is we co-added the images pixel by pixel. So we start off pixel by pixel because each of the pixels is represented by one number. And then when we go pixel by pixel, we can then create one scan line. And then after we get a scan line, we can keep adding those scan lines until we create our final image. So we keep on going until we get one final big clear image. Okay. And then here are the results from my project and what we were able to find by using our Python library and co-adding those images. So here are four sample images that were taken on the New Horizons mission. And as you can tell, they are all very different, but what's interesting is they're all taken at the exact same time. So it's really hard for scientists to see like which ones are static caused by radiation that's hitting off the sensors, and then which ones are stars that they actually once observed. So these are four sample images that I used in my Python library just to test if it would actually work. And then this is our final result. And what we did is we were able to remove the excess static that was interfering with the image and then combine it and co-add it to create one high quality image, which is shown on the right. So on the right, you can see how much of the static is truly gone after you co-add them. And then you're able to see right over here, that really bright spot is a star. So now you don't have any more static, and then you can actually observe what's going on around you and see what's actually star, what you actually want to observe. And I put this into more of a graphical format so that you can truly see exactly how the amount of static is truly reduced from image to image. So in images 1 and 4, which we saw 2 slides ago, I'm gonna go back and show you that again. In images 1 and 4, you can see that there's a lot of static going on there, and there's a lot of bright spots. So when you count the number of bright spots and put them into a graphical format, you can see how much greater that truly is in the final image. That's because there's so much more static than there are stars. So now you can finally take out all the static, and then you get very few bright pixels representing your stars, essentially. So at the end, we can in fact prove that the Python interpreter is going to be feasible, and it yields higher quality image data, and we can also increase the effective data rate. So this is different than the actual data rate, because the actual data rate cannot be changed, as I said before, but the effective data rate is essentially how much high quality data and how much important and relevant data you're actually getting back from your mission. So by increasing your effective data rate, scientists are able to observe more relevant data in a lower amount of time. And the wonderful thing about this is that it actually produces the same results as really expensive software that was used on New Horizons for essentially low, no cost. So it's also more flexible because it is an interpreter, which means scientists can write their own programs using our library and using the functions that we've already created for them in our library to get back data for themselves from the spacecraft. So in conclusion, we found a low-cost solution, and we were able to prove that the Python interpreter has the same co-adding capabilities as flight software that was used on the New Horizons mission. And it is in fact feasible to use a Python interpreter on Project Dragonfly because of all of this. So our next steps are to actually implement the Python interpreter onto Dragonfly flight software called VxWorks and get feedback from scientists analyzing image data. And eventually we want to potentially extend this to other NASA missions, but since I have done more work on my project since I've finished doing my presentation and et cetera, we have actually created a data system where we can store each of these images, and we call them blobs. And in these blobs, we store these images, and then we can use those to get back the higher quality image data from the spacecraft. So we added that into our Python program as well to make it even easier for scientists to analyze the images. And here are some acknowledgments that I use these resources in order to help me out with my project. And yeah, that's the end. Thank you.
That was a superb presentation, very nicely explained.
Thank you.
I have one question.
Yeah.
it sounded like you the use that you're thinking of for this camera is sky images of stars and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a little surprised at that because I figured they'd mostly want to look around at Titan itself and see what's on the ground. So would it work also for that?
So what my mentor was thinking is that they would be able to use the coedding capabilities from the Python library for like dust that's surrounding the instrument. So maybe you can take out that dust and then you would get a clear image of what's actually surrounding you, is what my mentor was saying it might be used for on the Dragonfly mission. But yeah.
And I see somebody else wrote a question. Why a Python interpreter instead of a compiled language for speed?
No.
Let's let Saraga explain that.
Okay. So the reason that we used a Python interpreter is because an interpreter inherently goes line by line, whereas a compiler takes it all together. And the reason that we want to go line by line is because it's easier to sort through the images, and you can get that one final image, the higher quality image, whereas with the compiler, you can't necessarily have those same capabilities. And it's a lot harder for a compiler language to easily read those files and spit them back out. Whereas with Python, people can automatically just type the functions that they want to use in, and then it can immediately execute that function, which makes it just a lot faster and more efficient.
Well, the question I have is, how much memory does the interpreter take, just roughly?
I'm not sure how much memory it takes.
Well, I'm just curious how much of a fraction of the total memory.
Yeah. That's a really good question.
Presumably, it's not much, because you need the memory for other things, right? So
yeah, I think the whole idea of our project was that it wouldn't take as much memory on the rotorcraft because we didn't really want it to. But I don't know exactly how much it takes because I haven't looked into that. But I'll ask my mentor and get back to you.
Okay, so NASA, is NASA following up on this? I mean, is this something they might want to do?
Yeah, so I'm actually working through the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory, since they're managing the Dragonfly mission. So I was working with my mentor to do that through them.
Okay, so when will Dragonfly launch?
2027.
Okay, but then my understanding is it's still going to take several years to get there.
Yeah, it's going to take a long time. And NASA's always running behind schedule, so there's no guarantee that it's going to launch even then.
Yeah, so you'll be way done with college and probably in grad school, if not already graduated by then.
Yeah.
Okay, well, good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, that was really good.
Thank you.
Saranga, first, great project. Thank you. Great presentation. My question is, did you take into account the possibility of the garbled or incomplete CCSDS packets? Or maybe that's something that comes down the road as the system develops further. Because the one time that I dealt with a program that was reading raw CCSDS packets, incomplete packets or garbled packets were not weren't common, but they were not uncommon. And it would tend to make the whole system fall over. So,
yeah. I mean, I guess right now where we are, if there was an incomplete packet, it would just be co-added. But that you wouldn't want that, obviously, because that would just create a bunch of unnecessary like dark spots, I guess.
Well, it sounds like it's not that it would just get co-added in, but the thing is, you would get part of the next packet without realizing it. And,
that's true.
And treating that as part of your image. So,
yeah.
So I have one more question. Did you know Python yourself before you started this project, or did you learn in by means of engaging in the project?
So I didn't really know much of Python. I knew like a little bit, but I didn't know much. And then I learned Python like throughout my project. So I had to do like other programs on the side in order to actually learn how to code Python. And then I had to do my project as well.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. That sounds like a very fun project, was it?
Yeah, it was. I think I learned a lot out of my internship, like a
Great.
Lot.
Great. Yeah. Thanks again. Thanks so much for doing this. And you'll be receiving some stuff in the mail from us if you haven't already.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure. I really enjoyed presenting. Thank you so much
for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. So I think now it's time for Steve Chen to give his report. Steve, you still there?
Good luck. I'm going to have to leave now, but good luck.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And so much. Thank you so much, Saraga.
Thank you. Bye.
And best of luck.
Thank you.
And come back.
I will.
Okay.
Cool.
Hey, Steve, go ahead.
Yep. I'll just share my screen.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Can you see this?
Yep, we can see it.
All right. So first, before I start this, it's like some few introductory words. So I'd like to thank you guys for, letting me present here. It's honestly like my pleasure to, finally talk about this project with, public at large. So yeah, I also like to thank, I guess first my lab, right? Like the Applied Physics Lab, which is where I believe the other presenter went as well. And also my mentor, Dr. Lance Boyer, who, just sort of guided me through most of this work. So yeah, this is my project, Inference of Distant Gravity from Local Measurements. To summarize, I basically just, I tested how accurately we could reproduce the gravity data in a given location by just taking very coarse measurements. To understand what that means, let's take a step back, right? So to state the obvious, the Earth is not smooth, right? We have mountains, we have valleys, we have buildings. All these things have mass and therefore slightly nudge what local gravity is. And so the field of physical geodesy is then dedicated to the study of these nudges. In our day-to-day lives, we usually don't think about these, right? You don't think about like how much your house is pulling on you. But as we move towards finer standards for navigation and measurement, they become more and more relevant. Therefore, to formalize all that talk, we needed to find a few quantities, or I guess objects. So the first is the geoid. This is an equipotential surface associated with the real gravitational potential. It's often contrasted with the reference ellipsoid, which is the smooth field that a smooth Earth would generate. One significant fact about the geoid is that because no point on it has like a higher potential than any other point, water always flows towards the geoid and doesn't, unless there's wind, doesn't flow outside of the geoid. Therefore, on average, we can just measure the geoid by measuring sea level height, which is very useful. To bring gravity back into the equation, we define the gravity anomaly vector as just the difference in gravity between a point on the geoid and a corresponding point on the reference ellipsoid. Because that's mostly just straight down and we want to work with scalars, we just take the magnitude of that vector and call it the gravity anomaly. For this project, I will be mostly working with just that final quantity. So I talked about how, I want to obtain the general field on a location from some coarse measurements, right? So let's just talk about what it looks like. In practice, in geodesy, we have two main ways of getting our data, right? The first is from satellites, and the second is from, ships on the sea. One of those things is obviously much better than the other one, right? Like, if you have a a boat which is physically on a at a location with a high quality gravity sensor, you will always beat, you know, a radar that's a few hundred miles up. However, ships are already limited because, you know, they have fuel requirements, they have food requirements, which means that you can't map the whole Pacific with a fleet of boats like you could with satellites. And so that motivates us to find a way to like squeeze as much information out of a ship's track as possible. So in this project, I will in many places just simulate this process. And here's what it looks like. We just take some data, right? We just get some data, which is either real satellite data or, as we'll see later, pseudo-random satellite data, and just, you know, smooth it out, find like a 2D spline, and just simulate a random walk. And along that random walk, we'll just quote-unquote sample the gravity anomaly, and then we'll record those locations. And then from that, we will just throw that into an algorithm and extrapolate out the full, you know, region. To do that, we use something called least squares collocation. And this algorithm, LSC, in turn relies on something known as the autocovariance function. This function is just, you know, associated with the gravity anomaly as a variable, right? It is just one of the intrinsic things associated with how it is, you know, like how it just generally forms. Qualitatively, this just, you know, tells us how closely related two points are given the distance. So if you have two points that are like relatively close to each other, like a mile apart, then you would expect them to be very strongly related to each other. So the ACF is very high for, you know, two points that are close together. But two points that are like 10 miles apart, you would expect them to not have much to do with each other, so the ACF falls off. This is the equation, well, I guess like the you know, basic core of LSC over here in the corner. It's very messy, but a big part of this is what is known as the autocovariance matrix. So for any given like arrangement of points, this tells you how every single point in that grid is associated with every other point. So you just number off all the points in some order, and you look at every single possible pair of autocovariances. It tells you how every point is related to every other point. And if you think about it, this is basically a fingerprint for, you know, how a field on that grid would look like. For example, if we think of a mountain, right, we call a mountain because the peak is taller than the surrounding land. So if you look at all the pairwise comparisons, we would just see that, like, you know, the peak is taller than the land. And so that gives us, so that sort of quote unquote ACM in that case would just, you know, gives a blueprint for describing mountains in general. In the same way, this gives us a mathematical description of like what the field should look like statistically. All right, so that's all well and good. So then to actually apply any of this, we need to find what the ACF is. A lot of work has been done on this, mostly by, you know, Jordan and also Gerber, who, you know, like made a, like, it's like a paper trail which led to this, you know, model for covariance. It's just a quadratic with a damping factor. However, there's still a catch, which is that, you know, in this function, we still have, you know, the scaling factor D, right? Like R is distance, but D is just some number. This is known as the correlation distance, and it essentially tells you how far apart the major features in the field are. And you can think of this as just like a scaling factor, right? Like if the distance is very large, then you're very, you know, zoomed in. If it's very close together, you're very zoomed out. And we don't really know which value of D we should use for this formula. We don't have like a perfect estimate for what it is for the real data. And so before we actually go for the fun part, we have to find D. To do this, I used Monte Carlo simulation. So if you know anything about Monte Carlo, you know that you have to have a lot of random data to work with. This data has to look like real gravity data, right? It can't just be, you know, completely random. It has to be simulated gravity data. More specifically, it has to, you know, have the same ACM as like the real data. And so to do that, we basically, you know, we apply something called the Chlesky decomposition to the ACM and just like multiply that by a random vector. So for any, you know, scale factor D, this just tells us, well, I guess like this returns a map that is equivalent to, or I guess satisfies all the conditions necessary for a real gravity map with that correlation distance. And so we generated, you know, like 10 sets of these for values of D rating from 10 to 100, right? these are some of those sample maps. I don't remember which value of D specifically this is, but this gives you like an idea for what these maps look like. They all look like they could be the same thing, right? These look like they could come from real maps, but none of them are actually real. So with this, we just tested a bunch of them. So we, once again, so for each of these like random maps, we essentially ran the, you know, like algorithm I mentioned before, which is just LSC. And then we use like a different value of D for like the actual computations with LSC just to see what would happen. And so this gave us a bunch of like, you know, output maps. And then we just needed to like find which value of D worked with, you know, which other value of D. To do that, we compare the power spectral densities of like the real and the extrapolated maps. And we did that mainly because like, okay, so I forgot what PSD is. If you don't know what the PSD is, it's the square of the norm of the Fourier transform of the data. And this essentially tells you like where the, you know, the details really being expressed in the data. And this is what D is really controlling, right? Like if you have a high value of D, then, you know, you'd expect the, you know, a peak speed farther out. And so if this is not preserved, then your fit for D is wrong. And if it is, if it matches the real value pretty well, then it's probably right. So we just check the R squared values for, you know, the PSDs in this case. And that gave us this sort of matrix. And yeah, as we can see, the best value for like the computation is around 50. And then with some fitting, we found that the real value somewhere around 40. So we just use those parameters. And so the final step of my project, I just took those parameters and just ran it on real data. I simulated traps of varying lengths and then checked those extrapolated maps against the real thing. And this chart over here sort of shows my results. So like as the path length got longer, we just got better and better results, right? The RMS error decreased and the, you know, correlation coefficient approached like one. And this number of like around 7.5 milligal, that's actually pretty good. So the real data has a RMS value of somewhere around 15, 20-ish. And it ranges between negative 100 and 100 milligal. So for like a basically, you know, for a pretty like unpolished, you know, like raw application of this algorithm, it did pretty well. And so this means that, you know, LSC is pretty viable for this sort of TD interpolation, right? We had pretty good results and, you know, it is a reasonably good fit. We also found that like, obviously longer paths, you know, affected how good the fit was, right? So over here, we can see two runs of this method. The first one with a relatively short path and the second one with a pretty long path. And obviously in the first one, you see like the major features, right? You have this like, I guess, C mount over here and you have a, you know, small valley. Those are expressed pretty clearly, but there's not much detail. You know, if you just like let the ship run for longer distance, get more data, you will get a significantly better map. So one issue we did find is that, you know, as you increase the path length, you don't really like, you can't really break through like this fundamental barrier in resolution. This is probably because covariance is an average. And so any average misses like the most extreme features. That's to be expected. But yeah, this shows that everything is feasible. Now, I'd like to talk about some, like, I guess, further extensions of this work. So first, let's talk about applications, right? In earth science, gravity data is extremely important because generally, like, you can't, you know, like, run surveys of the whole Earth, right? That's just, like, not feasible. And especially on the ocean, you can't, like, scan the entire Pacific with sonar or something, which means that gravity data is essentially our only way to, like, learn about the seafloor. And as shown over here, right, like this is a, I guess, a global map of like the vertical gradient from like UCSD. You know, like our knowledge of gravity anomalies has greatly increased our knowledge of this, like what's going on the seafloor. It's been refined to basically like an art at this point. And so by like improving our ability to gather more data, we can potentially like, you know, increase our ability to map everything out. The other application of gravity anomalies is in navigation. So as I mentioned before, right, like if you can easily measure, okay. So Mind Warp is essentially enabling us to, like, you know, collect more information about a region at a time. And so if you get that information, you can potentially match it against like a global map and figure out where you are with that. And I guess like a more loose application is in orbit determination, because, you know, gravity anomalies and like the Earth bulging is what causes like orbits to precess. And this is the stuff behind, you know, like sun synchronous orbits. And while the stuff like I'm discussing generally isn't on like the, like scales large enough to impact spacecraft like that much, things like the Greenland geoid high or the Sri Lankan like geoid low definitely do like impact that stuff. And I just like take this opportunity to like ramble about geophysics a little bit. So my work focused on gravity anomaly data, but there's nothing really like special about this, right? It's just data that is tied to different locations and, you know, is like more or less random. And that means that like the methods I use can be applied to like so many other parts of Earth science. Just to give some examples that are like actually being pursued right now. First is like agricultural crop yields, right? This is what like the geostats lab at UMD is doing. Mostly just like looking at satellite data and just, you know, mapping out how much like food people are growing. The second is like tectonic plate velocities. This is, there's a lot of work on this being done in like Europe right now. And it actually like, it's surprising like how much information and like techniques like they like share with my field. And finally, the original application of geophysics, which is mineral ore grades or like prospecting. So, you know, like my work, like, or at least the techniques I use in my work have like a very broad impact beyond just, you know, geophysics. And yeah, so I want to talk about like my own work a little bit. So in this, you know, in this project, I basically use LSC to like to extrapolate out gravity anomaly data from less gravity anomaly data. But LSC, because it you know, functions using just autocorrelence function, it can be, you know, twisted to like get to extrapolate any data from any other data. So this can be like, you know, vertical deflection data from gravity data, or maybe, you know, like geoid undulation data from vertical deflection data. What I'm currently working on is then like getting, you know, errors in satellite data from satellite data, which is basically I'm trying to like use LSC to, you know, basically unfuzz, you know, satellite radar data in order to, you know, globally improve our, you know, knowledge of the geoid. And so this is basically where I'm taking this next. And all right, so to conclude, I want to like talk about some applications of this to astronomy, right? The one question I got like constantly when I presented this to, you know, like, you know, like other panels is, does this apply to other planets? And I just want to preempt that here. The answer is yes, and it's extremely cool. So first, I just like talk about like why we want to do this. The most obvious answer is just like, we can't really go down and like, you know, do ground surveys of other planets very well, right? We've never touched down on Mercury. Our probes on Venus never lasted more than like a week, which means that we had to do most of our like Earth, our planetary science from orbit. And gravity data just tells us like basically everything we want to know about, like, you know, what's on the surface, like how thick the crust is, you know, if like how well differentiated the planet is, etc. And so like gravity data takes on even stronger importance with other planets. And so one, I guess, example of like gravimetry in space is GRACE, which is, you know, I believe it's like gravity recovery and climate, like the gravity recovery and climate experiment. It's basically just like having, which basically has like two satellites flying close formation and just like, you know, measure the, like the distance between them. And with like those, with the variations in that distance, they can, you know, sort of measure what gravity looks like beneath them. And this sort of, you know, technique has been deployed several times, twice on Earth, like twice around Earth with GRACE and GRACE follow-on, but also once on the moon with GRAIL. And yeah, so this is like one other method. But I think like the coolest method for, you know, just gravimetry in general is just using radio information. So the Deep Space Network is not something you think of when you think of like, you know, I guess NASA's scientific instrument, right? It's mostly just for tracking and communicating with spacecraft across the solar system. But it's also like the information it has to work with can also be used to obtain very high-precision telemetry. So, you know, as spacecraft move around, you see Doppler shifts. You can measure distance of them using phase shifts, which means that you can essentially like get a very accurate, you know, idea of like what a spacecraft is, like where the spacecraft is when it's in orbit around another planet. And with this, we can, you know, solve the inverse problem and just get very accurate like gravity fields of, you know, even Jupiter and Saturn. So, yeah, this sort of work has like major applications and like has been developed for like space tech. So yeah, just to end it off, I'd like to thank my mentors, Dr. Lance Boyer and Mr. Austin Turbeville, and also my research teacher at school, Ms. Andy Fossey, and of course my friends and family. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was very interesting.
Yeah, I had to look what a GAL was. I'd never heard of that unit before.
Yeah. Geodesy is a very esoteric field, I found. One GAL, I believe, is like 0.01 meters per second squared. And so a milligal is like actually a very, very tiny like unit of measurement.
Really tiny.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, also, Jeff, so like I saw a comment in the chat. It's pretty cool, like, you know, I had to read up on like glaciology and like, I guess, the Arctic geoid for one of my other projects. And yeah, it's pretty cool to see like, you know, Grace's results synthesized with like other missions like ICESat.
So I have another question. How did you get interested in this topic?
Yeah, so it's pretty funny actually. So when I signed up for the internship, my mentor gave me like a list of topics, right, that I could pursue. And one of them was basically this subject. And what struck me about it is that like it's not something that I ever considered before, right? You know, like normally you don't think of gravity as having, you know, like much, like containing much information, right? Like we normally just consider gravity to be just 9.8 meters per second squared straight down, but obviously it's not. And so I just like the opportunity to like dive deeper into the subject intrigued me a lot. So yeah, I just jumped at the opportunity and I've been working in this field for about a year now.
Very good.
So did the math that you took in high school so far, did that prepare you, or did you have to do a lot of extra learning of new mathematics?
Yeah, so some of it I actually surprisingly did learn in school, right? Like linear algebra and the like. But, you know, the background for a lot of this stuff is way beyond the stuff in my curriculum. For example, like spherical harmonics, that's not going to be like, you know, that doesn't go anywhere near like high school.
Very impressive.
Normally, geodesy requires calculus, differential equations, that sort of thing. So it's more of a post-college. So you have to take some calculus. And I believe they used to have actually sort of measuring devices with little masses attached to quartz springs, which geophysicists can actually move from place to place, and then measure the gravitational acceleration down to gals. But yeah, of course, a lot of that has been taken over by satellites in recent decades or whatever. So,
yeah, like really cool tech. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I was just going to say in response to Mike, the problem is satellites don't have very good spatial resolution. Then you get that resolutions of like several tens of kilometers. Where with a portable gravity, I forget the name of the instrument. Portable gravity detector there, as you were talking about, Now, you get a real point reading thing for wherever you put your instrument down.
So. It's like, to add on to what Jeff said, if I mentor, like, the real resolution of the maps we're using is around like 5 nautical miles, which is honestly pretty bad. There's nothing more accurate than just going out there and measuring it on the surface.
Right. But on the other hand, of course, with satellites, you can get essentially global coverage, whereas with the individual measurements on the ground, you're very limited in how many you can get and where you can go.
Yep.
Are there any more questions?
Yeah, let me ask a broader sense. How do you envision all of this being used to study, say, the cores of gas giants, Saturn and Jupiter, Neptune, or moons that are covered with ice, with water beneath them, oceans beneath them?
That's a pretty good question. So I'm not a planetary scientist, so I can't speak to the actual details of this, but I can say that you can recognize a lot of features with this sort of data. Of course you can calculate or I guess measure oblateness pretty easily by just it's one of the strongest features in the gravity field. But also you can look at so you can recognize major crustal features pretty easily as well. So like I mentioned, we have a pretty good way of identifying fault lines and seamounts. For example, fault lines are generally visualized as long strings of negative gravity anomalies, which means that if we see those features on another planet or moon, we can immediately recognize those as faults. I'm pretty sure there's also methods to determine how thick the crust is and how dense it is. So that might also be useful for Europa missions.
Thank you.
Okay. I guess one more question. I was looking at the abstract again. Can you remind us what's high school you're at? And
Blair? Yeah.
And what your plans are for next year?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so I go to Montgomery Blair High School. I'm just probably going to continue researching this over the summer. And then next year, I'm just probably just do more work and also, apply to colleges.
Okay, so you're a junior?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, keep up the really good work. Thank you very, very much. Can we have a round of applause from everybody? For Stephen?
Yeah, terrific work.
Yes, yeah. Very impressive. Very, very impressive.
Yeah, thank you very much for explaining it to us.
Okay. All right, so did we have anybody who was going to present sky images? I was trying to twist somebody's arm and they declined. And mine are no good. So, okay, well, I guess that basically finishes, but let me just...
Have we had the election?
We have had the election.
Oh, okay.
And you were re-elected. And
it was unanimous.
I see. Okay.
And so, yes, you were
vice president again.
Yeah, but this is going to be my last year, so I really do need someone to who I can bring up to speed on how to do it efficiently.
Okay. Good. Now, our next meeting is not in July. We do not have July or August meetings, but our next meeting is the second Saturday in September, and it's going to be a hybrid meeting. It's going to be the in-person part is going to be at the University of Maryland's observatory, and you can also join via Zoom. And if the weather cooperates, then we can use some of the University of Maryland's telescopes and look at anything that is viewable from there. So please come back and please come help out at Exploring the Sky. And I've also listed in Stardust, if you haven't gotten it yet, a number of summer observing sessions all over, you know, the eastern United States. If there's no more comments or questions.
Guy, I guess the board is going to meet sometime in August. Could you?
That's right.
The board is going to send us an email in time and all that.
Right. Good point.
We're definitely going to meet
in August. And looks like Elizabeth Warner has her hand up.
Yes. So sometime during July, August, I will be needing assistance from members to help me organize the lecture hall and get it ready for the meetings. We got rid of the trailer that we'd been using for storage in late 2019. And that means that a lot of stuff that was in storage there kind of got dumped into the lecture hall. And so we're going to need to reorganize and clean up and things like that during July and August. And I'll probably be needing some help with that.
Okay, please send an email.
And then it looks like there may have been four people actually recording the meeting. So all the people that I made co-hosts, I think all of y'all ended up recording the meeting, which is fine. I'll get the links from one of you that has maybe the longest or best recording. So don't delete anything. And we'll figure that out offline.
Okay, great. Okay, all right. Good night, everybody.
Hey, good night.
Good night. Have you saved any of your images from your Equinox, from your Unistellar 2? I don't know whether it heard me or not.
What was that?
Did you save any of your images from your Equinox, from your Unistellar 2?
No, he was actually talking.
Sure. Yeah, I have some images on my phone. Yeah.
Hey, your kitty cat.
Yes. Well, it's time for their snack.
Okay.
That's why they're both here.
Okay.
All right.
Good night.
Okay.
Everyone.
Good night. Good night. Bye.
Okay, so
they were talking about space.
Okay, yes.
Lots and lots of space.
Yes.